Okay, welcome everyone to the latest installment in the Warwick Post-Kantian Research Centre's series of uploads. My name is Alex Underwood, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Professor Jeffrey Bell of Southeastern Louisiana University, author of many books and articles on Deleuze and Deleuze and Guattari, just a few of which are What is Philosophy? A Critical Introduction Guide, Philosophy, the Edge of Chaos, and Deleuze's Hume. And that's going to be the most relevant today, because tonight Professor Bell will be giving a talk at the centre entitled Making Sense of Politics, Towards a Deleuzian Humean Political Theory. So today we'll be talking about issues of history, philosophy, and politics as seen by Deleuze and Hume. So Professor Bell, welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to our conversation.
So we'll start with the first question. In reading Hume and Deleuze together, you claim not that Deleuze has utilized Hume's thought for his own purposes, as one might expect, but that he has accurately extended threads already present within Hume's work, threads which you see as perfectly in line with the thought of Bergson. As you argue in your book, this seeming discrepancy between the two thinkers might explain why there is such a paucity of scholarship on Deleuze's relation to Hume. From Hume, we might say, Deleuze took the need for thought to be subject to practical aims and problems. But do you believe there are distinctions to be drawn between Hume's views and Deleuze's later metaphysics? And is Deleuze's scholarship still faced by this absence?
That's a very good question. I guess I'll begin where you ended, with absence. Is it still present? And to a large extent, I think it probably is. Though there has been some recent work. John Roth has recently published a book in the Critical Guide series from Edinburgh Press on the Deleuze's book on empiricism and subjectivity. But in general, Hume's work tends not to play into people who utilize Deleuze's work. In part, that's because a lot of people use Deleuze for cultural studies, critical theory, philosophy of cinema, philosophy of literature. And even though I think they could very well use Hume, and I'm trying to show how that can be done, you don't see a lot of work in that. Part of the reason for that may be that Hume is very identified with the Anglo-American analytic tradition in philosophy and not as quickly identified with a figure that continental philosophers or people interested in continental philosophy might be interested in. Which brings me to why was Deleuze, as one of the preeminent continental philosophers, interested in Hume? And I think in answer to your question, I think that actually over the years, the influence of Hume got stronger on Deleuze's metaphysics. In particular, I think by the late work, especially the What is Philosophy book that Deleuze wrote with Guattari, or mostly wrote, depending on your your perspective on that issue. I interpret that book, as I wrote in my book on that book, that what they're really doing in there is developing a concept of pedagogy, or learning. And so a metaphysics of learning was already present in Difference in Repetition, but it becomes, I think, much more important by the late work. And I think What is Philosophy in part helps to explain kind of what they were doing in A Thousand Plateaus. And I think the concept of learning was very important in the late metaphysics. And the learning comes in because for Deleuze, there's a metaphysics of problems that was already present in the work on Hume. In particular, Hume has this concept of delirium, the delirium of thought. And in late writings, Deleuze returns to this notion of delirium. And in discussing Hume, he will often mention that. So I think there is a return to Hume, at least implicitly, by the late writings of Deleuze.
Okay, that's very interesting. I have to say, I quite agree with this idea of Hume as recurrent, like the way through Deleuze and Guattari's philosophy. And, of course, Hume was in his own day known mostly as a historian rather than a philosopher. So if we could just turn to history quickly.
Sure.
So the range of historical references that you can find in Deleuze and Guattari's work, so from the Mongol horde to the Janissaries in the Ottoman Empire, the Roman legionary structure, I mean, these are just the first things that come to mind. I mean, there's so many of them. It's always been one of the most shocking aspects, especially of A Thousand Plateaus for me. Now, your work goes a long way towards contextualizing this inclusion of history. And you emphasize the importance of history as a form of problematization, or a problematization of history. The need to reach what Deleuze and Guattari call the unhistorical vapor that goes beyond the actual factors to the advantage of a creation of something new. So history then allows us to reach beyond our present conditions. rather than being simply a tool for understanding like how things came about or how we have reached the position that we're in. And to my mind, this is inseparable from revolution and social change as it's played out throughout history. Would you agree with this connection between history and revolution? And more generally, what role would you say that history plays within their work? Are they good historians, according to Hume's dictum, that a good historian be both impartial and interesting?
That's a great... I think the answer to the last question would probably be no, they're not good historians in the sense of being impartial and maybe truthful or accurate to the facts. But as you said, and said very well in your question, that was not really their primary concern in delving into historical matters. They, as they say on a number of occasions, there is the history of events, with events understood as the things that actually happened, the causal relationships between the things that happened, the relationships before and after, and so on and so forth. But then there's also the sort of problematic incorporeal period underneath, or the problems that historical events solved, problems that haven't gone away with their solutions. And I think this is where a historical analysis, both for Deleuze and Guattari, can be provide a kind of analytic or symptomatological, if that's a word, approach to our present situation, right? Rather than, and this is, I think, where you can probably put Deleuze and Guattari with Foucault and Nietzsche, just as Nietzsche would have said in his Uses and Abuses of History for Life, that history, even if it's false, right, you can learn a lot from, or you can problematize or find in the everyday something uncommon or something that provokes thought. I think that's what they are trying to do with their history.
So this idea of like Nietzsche's uncanny, for example.
Yes.
That's very interesting, especially this relation to Nietzsche. What I'd like to ask you about now is that institutions, or the role of institutions.
Yeah.
So in Control and Becoming, Deleuze tells Antonio Negri that what he first found in Hume was a creative reading of institutions and the law, and in particular a movement of institutions and of jurisprudence that would seem to take precedence over the law. So for Hume, of course, institutions are an essential means by which society is built. They ought to be formed from that society. And I see significant parallels here with Deleuze's later writings on May 68, and especially the language he uses of subjective redeployment at the institutional level. So what do you see as the role of institutions in Deleuze and Guattari's thought? Do you believe that institutional change is the, or at least a, aim of a Deleuzean Humean politics?
Yes, I think institutions are very critical to Deleuze's understanding of Hume, and I think implicitly important, especially in some of the late essays that Deleuze wrote, the Postscript on Control Society. I think that is an issue that surfaces there. But if we go back to sort of the canonical passage from Hume in his How Politics May Be Reduced to a Science essay, in that essay Hume claims that you can take two people, it doesn't matter what their talents or their abilities are, or not too much at least, and you put them into two different institutions, and whether they do a good job or not depends less on whether they are good and more on the institution themselves. So you can take a good person and they may end up doing excellent just because of the institutional structures and so on, and a bad person, they go on and do well because of the institutional structures. Because then, as a footnote, I've heard recently of a number of cases where people who've had friends and academics who were very much in support of the needs of academics and professors and so on, they enter administration, become provosts and so on and so forth, and suddenly that they are no longer acting on behalf of the professors they once claimed to. And one could easily say, oh, they're being hypocrites, or they are not being honest to themselves, which is perhaps partly true, but I think from a Humean point of view, what's going on there is they got put into this institution and certain aspects of the institution kind of forced upon them certain ways of acting, which I think is where Deleuze takes up the importance of Hume in contrast to Hobbes, because as he sees Hobbes sees the origin of the state as something that tells us what not to do. Right? It's a limitation on our rights so that we can live in peace. Whereas institutions for Hume, as Deleuze reads Hume, create an expansion of our interests. It creates a sort of interest in law and in being humane. And that's, I think, where the interest in institutions for Deleuze lies, and how we can go about tweaking institutions to sort of alter subjectivity. So you're right, it does, our subjectivity is in part. He gives the example in Instincts and Institutions essay about the pre-dinner drink.
Mm.
It's not something that we have an instinctual need for a pre-dinner drink, but institutional structures can certainly create the need for a pre-dinner drink. So that's just one trivial example of where that process plays itself out.
Oh, I see. So would you say it was a matter of these institutions matching up to the subjectivity that was already there, or this construction of subjectivity that you might see, like this creation of the need in people? Is it something that has to be made to match with subjectivity?
There, that's a good question. This is in part where I kind of see some of the work of Latour has been helpful for me, to kind of this sort of nature versus culture sorts of divides. And I would not claim that we have a pre-existent subjectivity that needs to then be molded to the sort of cultural institutional needs. Nor, however, are institutional cultural structures completely independent of the variabilities that subjects bring to an encounter. And I think that's the key component here, is this whole notion of an encounter or an event, something that has the potential to problematize a situation and can begin with changes between individuals in an encounter or how they think about one another, and can, in a way, and I think this is where the May 68 issue comes in, it can, in a way, kind of take off like a wildfire, and you can have this whole sort of unexpected phenomena take off. But, and I think this is also where institutions come in, if there's not a change in the institutional structures as well, the wildfire of social change and justice demands won't lead to anything. Just as what happened recently with the Occupy Wall Street movement.
I see.
It seemed to take off around the world. No one saw it coming, and it was a big deal for a while. And now, what has happened as a result of that? Not much. I mean, I do think we start talking about inequality more. I think that had it changed the conversation a little bit, but it didn't change most of the institutional structures that perpetuate the inequality that Occupy Wall Street.
I see. Almost like what Deleuze says about May 68 itself.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.